Without much further ado, let's start. So our focus today is Yerushalayim as the convergence of worlds. And this is really important to think about because tonight is Yerushalayim, is Yom Yerushalayim. So in thinking about that, we'd like to try to appreciate some of the aspects of Yerushalayim and its significance to us, especially now, because right now, as we are experiencing, Yerushalayim is on fire, unfortunately, as a function of some disgruntled folks, unfortunately, and there's a lot of unrest. And whenever you read about the unrest, you always see this unbelievable. These unbelievable falsehoods which are proliferated, America's telling Israel that both sides need to issue restraint. Both sides, so the police need to be very careful about issuing restraint about how they apprehend terrorists, And you hear these things like that, this is one of the most important sites, holy sites for Islam, and the Western Wall is one of the most holy sites is the most holy site for Judaism, as if the Western Wall itself is the holiest site. There's a lot of falsehood which has proliferated, which is why it's important for us to re-educate ourselves and reaffirm that this is not just happenstance. It isn't that we're just, that we need to share these multi-ethnical areas. And of course, Jews have been the only nation which have been tolerant of other nations using their shrines for worship. But nonetheless, it is important for us to understand that this goes back much further than simply a little squabble in the 20th century. This is something which predates Islam and Christianity long before those two religions were born. We need to appreciate what Judaism has to say about it. So let's start at the very beginning. Where is Mr. Mail? Where's Mr. Mail? Mr. Mail is back in Shir. This is such a wonderful, wonderful moment. We really, really appreciate seeing you back. It's been a very long absence. Baruch Hashem, it's superb to have you back, and this is going to be an even better season now. Let's start off by thanking, I'd like to thank Tibby and Elise Schwartz, who are sponsoring for today's shiur for the yahrzeit of Tibby's mother, Mrs. Magda Schwartz, Leah Bas Yitzchak Alea Shalom, whose zechus is untold in terms of the amount of Baruch Hashem, continued zechus, continued hashpah in this world, continues in her name. And it's also we'll add in the mazel tov to on two granddaughters just born a few short weeks ago. Be'ezras Hashem, they should bring continued aliyas neshama to Mrs. Leah Bas Yitzchak. Also, want to thank David Foyer, who is sponsoring for the Boy Bayom Yard site of Rachel Bas Alta Chaim Binyamin. That's David Foyer's mother, whose yard site is today. And it is a time where Baruch Hashem we continue to see that hashbah. We continue to see the influence that she had in this world. It's funny because I always think around the time of your dad because we're approaching June, and then we're approaching D-Day and the time that he served the Jewish and the American people. So Baruch Hashem, there's a lot to talk about. Thank you for being part of this. Let's focus, folks. In terms of Judaism, we know that Yerushalayim, and I've spent a bit of time on this in other shiurim, but let's start actually on source 3 for a second, and then I'll come back to the beginning. Judaism has a very significant space for Jerusalem, and the more we appreciate, the less we have to excuse ourselves for living there and calling it our capital. So the Gemara tells us in Bereishis, Tesvav and Aleph, V'aldo taninon adam mi'asar de beis hamigdash nofak. Adam, or humanity, came out from the place where the Beis HaMikdash should be. Meaning to say, where was the earth carved out for the body of the first human being was from the Beis HaMikdash itself. In fact, that the Medrash Rabbah explains and goes further, Min HaAdama, it says, Rabbi Berechev, Rabbi Chelba, B'Shem, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman, Amru, Mimakom Kaparosoi Nivra. Humankind was created from the place of their atonement. So that's why it says, when the pasuk is commenting on is min ha'adama, that Adam was created from the earth. And if you look at the end of Parashas Yisrael, mizbeach adama tivneli, when you should make for me an altar of adama, what the Midrash seems to be picking up on is that we shouldn't misconstrue or misunderstand. Adama also means similar to Adam, similar to Adam HaRishon, which is being created. Why was he created from the place of the Mizbeach? Why is the altar related to Adam? Mimakom kaparosai nigma. From the place of his atonement would we be where he is quarried from. Now, there's a lot to think about when it comes to that, because you could say, well, what that ultimately means is that he's destined to sin, right? Because he's going to need this place to atone for him. At the same time, it's almost as if the antidote is included, meaning to say, break the glass in case of emergency. That's essentially, he is built in the place of the Mizbeach. This is the first of three entities, or three aspects of the Beis Hamikdash, which are going to be relevant to us. And the first being the Mizbeach. The Makom HaMizbeach is the place where Adam was created. In fact, the Gemara in Sukkah goes to an incredible length talking about the idea of what's called the Shisin. The Shisin were two pipelines which were in the Mizbeach, and the way it would be used is that throughout the course of the year, they would have a libation every day. It would be a wine libation. They would bring wine, they pour it down one of these pipes. However, on Sukkot, so the celebration of the Simchas Beis HaShoeva would be when they would pull out water from the spring and they'd put it down the pipes instead of the wine. And Simchas Beis HaShoeva would be celebrating that process in the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara in Sukkah describes where did these pipes go to. So there was a cavity underneath the Mizbeach. And the Gemara says that in fact that was the cavity from which humankind was, so to speak, excavated, quarried from. The material part of what we'll call the carbon-based life form was created from. Fascinating, right? So we have this sort of starting point where even all of humanity that is focused around Jerusalem. It goes a little further. Because after Adam sins, after Adam Arishon and Chava sin and they are booted from Gan Eden, we're told a fascinating thing. And this is actually based on the Targum Yonasan, who translates the pasuk about the Akedah. We know famously in the Akedah that Avraham Avinu takes Yitzhak and places him on Har HaMoriah. On the translation of that pasuk, the Targum Yonasan is really an untapped resource. Most people don't realize that it's actually Midrashic insight into the Pesukim. It's much more than simply a translation. Unculus is an Aramaic translation with sometimes annotations. So there'll be times where Unculus will reinterpret words based on what it's meant to mean. The Targum Yonasan does much more than that. Here's an example. Take a look at source 6. Va'asu la'asra de'omar Hashem. They came to the place that Hashem said. This is about the Akedah. Ubonot samon Avram yos madabucha. And he made an altar. So again, this is Aramaic. It sounds very similar. This is in source 6. It sounds very similar to Hebrew, but it's the Aramaic of it. De'bono Adam. So what happened is when Adam was expelled from Yerushalayim, he made an altar in the place. In other words, this was Mimakom Kaparosa Nivra. So he tried to appease, he tried to find a degree of kapara by making the Mizbeach. Where did he make the Mizbeach? In the place, on Har HaMoriah, on the place that he was created. So that's sort of the full circle of that place. But Tav Noach Ubenaye, Noach rebuilt it, right? Because after the flood, it was destroyed. V'ischaper bedora v'ispekar bedora de palgusa, and it was destroyed during the generation of the dispersion. Bereshis Perikud Aleph. That mizbeach was destroyed. V'sodor Eloi yos kismo. Okay, and then it goes on to describe the Akedah itself, how he set up the mizbeach there. So what the Targum Yonasan says is there's a long string of history over here. In fact, so we have Adam created from it. Adam atones for himself on it. It remains a shrine all the way until the times of Noach, which is a very significant amount of time. And at that point in time, it's well over a millennia. Then it's destroyed. Noach rebuilds it. It's the place Noach actually sacrifices after the ark comes to rest. And then finally, it's destroyed at the Dor HaPalaga, rebuilt by Avraham Avinu. So there's a lot of very important historical, we'll call it, episodes that occur here. But more than that, in fact, it's a little more than that as well. The Targum Yonasan actually describes that when Avraham Avinu, when Noach builds this Mizbeach, in source 7, Vayivin Noach Mizbeach LaHashem Yikach Mikol BaYemei HaTahara Mikol Oifo HaTahar VaYal Oilos BaMizbeach. So when Noach actually builds his altar upon his exiting, now we think at this point in time he's in Turkey, right? Because after all, Har Ararat, there's a whole academic debate as to where exactly did this live? Like, where was this altar. So it's interesting where the mountain of Ararat was, where north is it? There's a lot of interesting arguments. But the Targum Yonasan once again argues that the Mizbeach wasn't necessarily the place that he exited. It could have been that he traveled to another place for it. What is that? So again, the Targum Yonasan says in Source 8, Ubonanach Madbacha Kodem Hashem, Hu Madbacha Debono Av Adam Be'idon De'itredid Min Ginza De'eden. He built the Mizbeach in a place that in that Adam had originally made his altar. So this connects to the previous Targum Yonasan. Now, but he adds an extra point. And in fact, he says, there's a missing link, and that is as when Cain and Hevel had that little dispute about whose sacrifice was accepted before Hashem, they too were using the shrine or the altar of their father, which was in the same place. So every significant link in the generations we see in this specific place. So then at this point in time, Noach rebuilds it and sacrifices on it. Fascinating. So we have this really long chain in history, but it gets a little deeper. This is a point that I had not seen before. I had not realized this. So it turns out this is actually, in case we think that this whole dispute over Jerusalem is a new issue, is something which is just recent, it's in the news, it's because it's the latest hot piece of news commodity. Truth is, this is actually an ancient fight, a very, very ancient fight. It goes so far back as to really essentially the second generation of living humans. Why? What I mean? So the whole world was wiped out. Noach comes out of the Teva, and he has a few children. There was a little bit of a dispute between those children, as you remember. There's Shem, Cham, and Yafes. Cham does not respect his father. What he does to his father, or what he does not do to his father, is a matter of debate. But be as it may, Noah curses Cham, and he gives the blessing to Shem and Yafes to protect his dignity. That's what we see happening immediately after the flood. Interestingly enough, that actually has to do with Yerushalayim. Why does it have to do with Yerushalayim? The answer is that if you take a look at in Source 9, in this is the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha, we hear that Avram Avinu comes to the land of Canaan, Vayavor Avram Ba'aretz, Ad Mekom Shechem, Ad Elan Moreh, Vaknani Az Ba'aretz. And then the Canaanites were in the land. That's a very complicated phrase. Those three words are the matter of so much debate, Vaknani Az Ba'aretz, because you see what happens is some folks say, you see, the writer of the Torah was saying then it was the Canaanites were in the land. But if Moses was the writer of the Torah, well, the Canaanites were still in the land. So how does that work? So there's a lot of fascinating discussions around this particular phrase. And the even Ezra, there's a lot of stuff going on over here. Rashi says very simply, without going too much further discussion about who's writing it and how the Torah talks about then, right? Is the Torah prophetically asserting then? But nonetheless, why is it relevant to us that when Avram Avinu comes to the land of Canaan, the Canaanites are in the land? Why is it a significant point? So Rashi tells us, this is a basic Rashi in the Torah, but it's such a profound insight. Really, the land of Israel was Semitic territory. The land of Israel was Semitic territory. Semitic meaning children of Shame. But they are being conquered at this point in time from the children of the Canaan, which is the children of Cham. Right? So that's the other side of the family. Shebechelko shel Shem naflo kesharolak Noach es ha'aretz. Shenema Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem, Salem. Shalem is the area of Malki Tzedek. Malki Tzedek is Shem. Right? Lefichach v'yomer Hashem el Avram lezarach v'yitein es ha'aretz hazois. Asir ani lachzira levonecho Shem yizarach shel Shem. Why was it? Remember we saw in that Targum Yonasan, it says that at the time of the Dora Palaga, they at the dispersion generation, they destroyed the altar. Part of the reason is because there was a shift in power in the Middle East. And the shift in power was with the two sides of the family vying for the same territory. One side of the family was Cham and the children of Canaan, taking it away from Shem. Ultimately, when Avraham Avinu has promised the land, he has promised the land that really was his, which was promised to him as well, fascinatingly enough. In fact, I was actually just reading, and really I recommend it for everybody. Rabbi Arya Kaplan has a reader called Jerusalem, the Eye of the World. He had such unbelievable pamphlets. Anything you read from Rabbi Arya Kaplan is worth the time reading it. It's really unbelievable. So in his pamphlet, which originally, by the way, he was writing for NCSY, just fascinating in terms of youth, halavai, our youth, would read anything of this nature. You know, it's amazing. So he wrote about the Shabbos and Tvilin and Mikveh and Tzitzis and Yerushalayim and the Yud Gimel Midos. He wrote all these small pamphlets. In his pamphlet about Jerusalem, so he writes an interesting thing. He points out that Jerusalem was divided into a lower and an upper city. And the lower city was occupied still by the Semites, by Shem, Malki Tzedek, and the upper city was conquered by the Canaanites. Which is why you'll always see these discrepancies later on when you read Tanakh between the conquest of Yehoshua and then later on at Shoftim and David HaMelech, you'll see there's a semi-conquest of Jerusalem. And that's because there were different areas. There was the valley and there was the mountain, the adjacent mountaintops. One of those remained in the high hands of the Semites, one of them hands remained in the hands of the Canaanites as well. Just fascinating. The debate goes back so far. So Avraham Avinu is walking into a land which is, so to speak, conquered by foreigners. That's how far back it goes. So when he goes and he does the Akedah, essentially what he's doing is he's reclaiming the territory which really belonged to him as well. Let's drive that a little further.
Who gave Noah the power to divide up the land?
I guess if you're the only surviving human, it's probably a good start. I'm saying, like, imagine, it's a blank slate. Right? There ain't no more folks. There's no tribes. Right? There ain't no native anybodies at this point in time. So he says, so what he does is, Yishkona Bo'alei Shem. What's the O'alei Shem, as is understood by some of the Midrashim? The O'alei Shem is, this is going to be your place. I know in the future this is going to be your place. You can establish your tent here and so on. After the Dora Palago, where there was this dispersion, that's when there's suddenly now you have Canaanites now descending, and also extensions of the Canaanites, the Mitzrim, descend now from Mesopotamia into the Middle Eastern area and to the Egyptian area. That's when the Canaanites take over that particular region. Right, so he had the right, I assume, you know, by better than any other, certainly better than the gold rush out west, you know what I'm saying? So it was that sense of control, that blessing he gave to Shem, was ultimately took a long time to come to full fruition. So we see that, in fact, Shem himself, under a different name, he was called Malki Tzedek, Melech Shalem. So you know when you go around, there's all these Salems. I never realized this. Salem is, the most famous Salem was Jerusalem, right? So that's where it came from. So he was the king of Shalem. And this is the way that the Tanakh or Torah refers to Jerusalem. And we hear that he comes out after Avraham Avinu has this war against the oppressing colonizers. In this case, the four kings, Kedar Laomer, Hammurabi, all these folks, right? So then he takes back the territory. After he takes back the territory, Malki Tzedek comes out because he was under the oppression. He was paying taxes for 13 years to these folks in the north. Human beings just don't seem to get it right. You give them just a little bit of time and they're all killing and oppressing each other. It's amazing. Anyway, so now that they're freed from their oppressors, Malki Tzedek comes out and he gives a blessing to Abraham. He gets to Avraham Avinu. We're told that in fact, that where is Shalem? In case you're wondering, Tehillim says, Shalem Tzion and Salem are the same place. Zion is Zion, right? Zion is Jerusalem. That's the adjacent mountaintop to Har HaMoriah. They're the two mountaintops which are next to each other. Then we, of course, hear about the Akedah, which where Avraham Avinu is charged to go to this place. What's fascinating about the Akedah is, in this regard, is that Avraham Avinu is not told precisely where it is. He says he's told that he's going to go to Eretz HaMoriah, the land of Moriah. I'm going to show you where exactly, so to speak. When you get there, I'll give you further instructions. Which is really the model for all of Israel, right? Israel is the same thing. The nation of Israel is in the desert. Hashem says, you're going to go in, you're going to have this place, this Shichno, Sidra, Shul, Vasa, Shama is going to be a special place, but instructions are pending, right? So you'll get there, and I'll tell you when. The Rama Memorah Nevuchim we've looked at beforehand explains the reason why that was important is because if Hashem had told them where Jerusalem was immediately, what would happen is first of all the non-Jews would go and destroy the place, right? And, you know, and put minefields around it because they know that it's a special place to us. Horiah is look at history since the time we have told everybody it's important, but also he says because the Shvatim themselves, the tribes would also have internal civil warfare because they'd all want to have that place. So Hashem said, I'll tell you when you get there. Once we've divided the land up and once you've conquered the land, then I'll tell you where it is. And that's what happens. That's the model that Avraham Avinu is doing over here. You're going to go to the Eretz HaMoriah and then I'll tell you. Same thing over here. And then he has this whole moment. In fact, at the end, or end of the Akedah, he calls the land or the mountain Har HaMoriah or Har Hashem Yeroeh. And we're told in Dirayamim, Ezra identifies, in case we think this is historic revisionism, you know, in case we think, well, we like to see Jerusalem everywhere, the truth is Ezra affirms that for us. Yerushalayim and Har HaMoriah are the same. Okay, in fact, the name Yerushalayim is a combination of Har Hashem Yeroeh and Shalem. Yeroeh Shalem, Yerushalayim, is in fact the way that the Torah identifies it, so it goes all the way back to this. Later on, we have the episode where, one last interesting point, and this is something I never knew as well, is after the Akedah, we're told that Avraham Avinu descends back down the mountain with Yitzhak. We're told in Source 15, Vayeshev Avraham el Na'arav, Vayakum Vayechul Yatov Be'er Sheva, Vayeshu Avraham Be'er Sheva. What do you notice is strange by that in that pasuk? Where's Yitzhak? Yitzhak was just about to be sacrificed. Avraham Avinu comes down the mountain. Where's Yitzhak? He didn't bring Yitzhak. He forgot Yitzhak after all that. What happened? Says the Targum Yonasan once again. Udvaru malachim aroyma yas Yitzhak. The malachim took Yitzhak. Vavilohu levei midrasha to shame. And they took him to the academy of shame. Vahavos tamon tlas shnin. And he was there for 3 years. Meaning to say, Avram didn't come down from the mountain because Yitzhak was retained there for the in the basement of shame. The argument that is made, and based on a number of midrash and the Pirkei to Rabbi Eliezer, is that where was the academy of shame for Ever? Where was Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem living? In Shalem. Which means to say that sometimes we sort of, you know, when you think about the Akedah, you think of Avram Avinu traveling to the wilderness and the territory of, you know, mountains and clouds, and there's no one there. Truth be told, is right next door was Shem, because he was the king of Shalem. And when Yitzhak didn't return, where was he that he wasn't returning? He was on the adjacent mountaintop or the adjacent valley where Shem's academy was, which is why it describes Avram Avinu coming down by himself. Just fascinating. So I mean to say that was the encampment of shame and the continuation of this, the sort of the last stronghold of the Semites in the Canaanite territory. Just a fascinating perspective of this as well. Later on we have Yaakov Avinu. Famously, he's on his way up to go to his uncle. We're told in Parshas Vayetze in Source 17, Vayifka Mamakom, he came to this place, Vayalin Shonki Vashemesh, Vayakah Mabna Makom, Vayisham Vayas Mirashazova, Yishka Mamakomahu. And he sleeps that night, he has his dream, there's his ladder going up to heaven, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's at the top, he's at the bottom, and in the morning he wakes up, the last pasuk, he says, this must be the house of God, and this is the gateway to heaven. So there's all debate in Rashi and the Ramban, where was he sleeping, where was the ladder pointing, the ladder was at a slant, so was he in Beis El, and the ladder was above Yerushalayim. According to the classic Mepharshim, he is actually sleeping on Har Moriah, same place, and he says, this is the Shar HaShamayim, this is the gateway to heaven. What you see is an interesting thing. You see that the Yerushalayim is identified as having three interesting properties in this historical trajectory. One is the element of the Mizbeach, right? That's where Adam HaRishon was carved out of, was the place of Kapara. The other aspect of it is you also see the academy. That's where Shem was, right? So Shem's yeshiva was over there. And finally, you see the notion of prayer or sacrifice, right? Prayer, which is when he talks about Shar HaShamayim, he's not referring to the Mizbeach aspect of it. What implement or place of the Beis HaMikdash is Yaakov been referring to? Is essentially the Aron, the Makom of the Shekhinah, the place where the Shekhinah, the aperture of the Shekhinah is. So what's interesting is actually Rav Arya Kavlin points this out, I think it's a very profound point, is that the Beis HaMikdash has all three of those, right? So it has the Mizbeach, which is a place where we sacrifice to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It has the Lishka Gazis, which is where the Sanhedrin, the academy, so to speak, where Torah law is adjudicated, but not just adjudicated, but is also synthesized, is in the Lishka Gazis, in the Sanhedrin of 71. And then you have the Aron, which is ultimately the aperture for all prayer, right? So you have all three of these in the historical chosenness of Jerusalem. Fascinating. Now, the question we have to ask ourselves is why? Why is that the case? Why was Jerusalem the place that was chosen for all of this? You know, so it has these different facets to it. These different facets expand over the course of history. Why was it so important? Why was it chosen there? So one thing which is worthwhile noting is that Jerusalem really is the center of a lot of things. Center of a few things which is important, and take a look at page one as an example. So the copy doesn't give this very, very, it does not copy this too well, but this is actually a picture of Mesopotamia in the Middle East, and you'll see what's called the Fertile Crescent. It's actually supposed to be a little darker, but the photocopy did not catch that properly. The Fertile Crescent is essentially, if you were to look at a satellite picture, there's a large desert in Arabia, right? In the Arabian Peninsula, essentially. And that takes up, that's an almost non-traversable area. The area that would be the trade routes would be from Mesopotamia between the Tigris and Euphrates River, which is sometimes known as the cradle of civilization. And it moves its way down through the Lebanon, through Israel, down to Egypt, to the Nile Basin, right? That's called the Fertile Crescent. And it was essentially the essential trade route from the two land masses of civilization at the beginning, which was Euro-Asia and Africa. Right, so anybody who wanted to bridge those trade routes needed to go through that thin strip of land called Israel. So when they talk about Israel being the center of the world, it means HaKadosh Baruch Hu orchestrated in such a way, which is why, by the way, geographically speaking, whenever Israel was attacked, where was the area of attack always from? It was always, almost always, from the north. It was never from the east. And part of the reason is because the armies could never cross the east. No army could cross the Arabian desert. It was always Mitzion Tipotach Ara, says Yirmiyahu. It was always from the north. That something means something spiritually, but it also means geographically. It was because it was from the Fertile Crescent. Now, I do want to make a point. If you type in Fertile Crescent and you look for all the maps, I am astonished by the inaccuracies of history. Almost every map has Mesopotamia, ancient Egypt, and then it has Palestine. It's like, there wasn't a Palestine then, folks. It just didn't exist. Palestine was a later Roman name. When there was Mesopotamia and there was Assyria, there wasn't Palestine. It was called Israel. You want to try to be talk Canaanite, that's fine. It's just amazing, the revisionism in history. You have to be accurate. Palestine was later on. That was after. That was in we'll call it common era. At that point in time, there weren't Assyrians. Right, so just it's important that this is one of the few maps I was able to find in research gates, which actually enabled us as Canaan, as opposed to misinterpreting and reversing history. So, but nonetheless, that it's essentially the center of the trade routes. But it goes on further. If you think about Israel, Israel also is not only the convergence of, we'll call it travel, it's also the convergence of old and new at the same time. Meaning, so you go to Israel today, and you can go through, you know, tours where you're witnessing 2,500 old structures subterraneously, and you're seeing, we'll call it history in front of your eyes. And at the same time, you can go within a 5-minute drive and go to the most advanced technological research laboratories as well. Right, it's the convergence of new and old, but it's also the convergence of east and west today. Meaning to say, if you think about it, when you go to Israel, you'll have the technologies which are developing. You know, that right now they're developing a nasal spray which can help prevent virus spreading. Whereas at the same time, you'll go and it has the greatest meditational places of spiritualism of the east and the advanced medicine of the west. So ancient and new, western and eastern. And we'll call it all trade converging around one place. Jerusalem really is, in a certain sense, the center of all of human activity. And it still is, even though the trade routes have now turned in a different direction. So Jerusalem really is the center. But it's more than just being the center. The reason why it is the center, this is a reflection of an innermost point. And that is that, in fact, it wasn't just about humanity being created there. It's about the world being created. And this is a very hard point to grapple with in the mind. The Mishnah tells us in Yuma, Daf Nun Gimel Amabes. So we're in the Daf, folks. This is on our charter. So the Mishnah tells us that the Kohen Gadol would perform the Avodah, and the most critical part of the Avodah would be when he comes in to the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and he'd place the Ketores in front of the Aron, and then he would sprinkle the blood towards the Aron. So the Mishnah, if you remember, is authored at the end, after the second Beis HaMikdash. And during the second Beis HaMikdash, there was a different practice than during the first Beis HaMikdash. Why? The Mishnah tells us, Mishanitel Aron, when the Aron was taken. When was the Aron taken, folks? Just historically speaking. When was the Aron no longer present above ground in the Beis HaMikdash? Times of Yoshiyahu HaMelech. So the tail end of the first Beis HaMikdash, Yoshiyahu put it into the catacombs below, in the subterranean tunnels below the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And at that point in time, so what would the Kohen Gadol do? So the Mishnah says, Evan Ha'isashama, there was a stone which was there, or we'll call it rock, right? I think other folks took that from us, right? That they made a dome over it. And so there was a rock there. Mimois Nevi'im Rishonim, Ushasiya Ha'isa Nikres. And it was called Shasiya. That was the name of the rock. Ugevoyim and Arts Shosha Etzbois, and it was slightly higher than the floor. Three fingers higher than the floor. And that's what he'd place the cups of the incense and the blood. not tell us Adami Misha Yomemores, Lo Nichnas Malkush Nichnas. And then it goes on to describe the avoid of the Kohen Gadol. Fascinating. What's the history of the stone? So this rock, the Gemara tells us on the next page, which is in source 2, Ushasiya, it's the next page in the Gemara, same page in the notes, the Gemara says in source 2, Ushasiya Shashama Nikres Tana Shemimeno Hushtas Ha'olam. That's a really difficult concept to wrap our minds around. That means to say, from it the world was nursed. That's interesting. That means to say, the world was nursed from this rock. So we're not talking about now about humanity, world, and Hashem carves out the, you know, so to speak, the body of this, you know, inanimate object and then puts an neshama into it and now becomes a human being. No. The world itself, the universe, is nursed from this rock. And this goes in accordance to the one who says that from Zion, the world was created. What does that mean? That's a very, very hard concept to understand. So one way of looking at this is that in a certain sense, the notion of space started in this spot, right? So space is one of the two physical constraints of existence. Time is the other one. And all of space was nursed out of this spot. When you say the notion of the constraint of space started here. This is the point of expansion, which is fascinating, which is why space isn't a physical constraint in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. If you think about this, because we know there's a number of examples that Gemara in Bava Basra talks about where space doesn't operate in the same way in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So as an example, the Gemara says if you were to measure the Kodesh HaKadoshim in the times of Shlomo HaMelech was 20 by 20 cubits, roughly 40 feet by 40 feet. And if you were to measure, the Aron itself took up 2.5, right, by 1.5. So if you were to take a tape measure out, now the Kohen Gadol would have to do this, right? So, but if somebody were to take a tape measure and measure from the wall of the Aron to the wall of the Kodesh HaKadoshim on the one side, it would be 10 amos. And you take out a tape measure on the other side and you measure from the wall of the Aron to the other side, it would be 10 amos, which just gives you a little bit of a physical problem because it took up space itself. But the Gemara says the Aron eino min hamida, which means to say the Aron did not take up place. So it's sort of, you could see it, you could touch it, but it actually didn't. You shouldn't touch it, but it didn't take up the space that it was existing in. Some of the examples that Shlomo HaMelech made these kruvim, these angels, and if you measure their wingspans, again, their wingspans was 5, 5, 5, 5, which is essentially 10 and 10, right? And the wings were touching each other and the walls, but then there was no space for the actual body of the kruvim. Now, they didn't have the wings coming out the back of their neck, the back of the their spine, they were coming out like arms, which means to say the center of the kruvim's bodies was also not a non-measurable item. Why are these properties relevant to us? Because in a wormhole, which is essentially the interface between two dimensions, that wormhole shares the properties of both sides of that aperture. So which means to say, if this is the place where space essentially is generated from, it shares the properties of an area which doesn't have space as well, which is why space doesn't operate in the same way. Fascinating. This is a fascinating thing. But let's take it a little further. This is the argument. And tell me if this makes sense. This is a very esoteric argument. And again, I'm just quoting from Rabbi Arya Kaplan. Rabbi Arya Kaplan was a very profoundly deep individual. He says the following. What is the difference between physical and spiritual? Right? What would you say is the primary defining difference between physical and spiritual? I mean, we know it. We of course, right? But you sort of articulate that. So the primary difference, he says, is that physical entities occupy space. Right? So therefore, differentiation of a physical entity is by space. And space is not a constraint in the spiritual realm. So if that's true, what distinguishes items or entities in the spiritual realm? It can't be space. So what is the distinguishing factor? What was that? No, not time. It's a good guess, though. Time is the extra action, outer constraint. That's why time doesn't operate in the Kodesh. The bread, the showbread not aging, the wick's not going up. That's the outermost constraint. Innermost constraint is space, right? But so it goes time, space. But what is one of the, just if you think about this, what is the differentiating property? If you don't have space, so let's say we're in the spiritual realm right now, right? We're in the celestial realm of angels, right? So what differentiates them if it's not space? You can't say angel number one is here and angel number B is there because here and there aren't concepts in the spiritual realm. So what differentiates them? Concepts, right? Which means, you know the beginning of Parshas Vayera, and it says there were three angels and Avraham Avinu and the whole business, right? And then the question is, why are there three angels? So what does Rashi say? Why do they have to be three angels? Right, because they got different jobs, right? So, well, what are their jobs? One of them is about to do is about telling Avraham Avinu about the message of the Leidas Yitzchak. One of them is about to, is for the refuah, right? And the other ones are going to be about on the way to the destruction of Saddam, right? So there's this, we have, that's why we have a triad. So if you think about this for a second, why is it so relevant? Because in the spiritual realm, the only thing which differentiates entities is the idea itself, the mission. If there were to be two missions, they would automatically differentiate into two entities. It would be the same mission, they would converge into the same entity. Because there's no spatial differentiation. Fascinating. But let's think about this for a second. So therefore, in the spiritual realm, two ideas or two concepts or two missions can't coexist in the same, we'll call not space is not the right word, right? They can't coexist, right, in that plane of existence. Make sense? If they are the same thing, they are one. If they're different, then there are two. So now, that being the case, what's fascinating is how can you get two spiritual concepts, two separate ideas to converge into one entity? And the only answer is through when you limit them into physical space. Which means, if I now attach a spiritual idea into a physical entity, I can use the physical entity, which is essentially a perimeter, which is a, we'll call it a limitation, to limit two spiritual ideas into the same place. Brilliant. So that means to say, what's a primary, a great example? A good example is a human being, right? So a human being is a material item, is an organic piece of biological material. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu now pulls together different ideas and harnesses that neshama, which has conflicting spiritual ideas, into a physical form. If the physical form wasn't constraining it, those spiritual ideas would not be able to coexist. So when you think about it, why is an angel not have a yetzirah, or have the ability to choose, so to speak, is because conceptually it's an angel is fully spiritual. It doesn't have the space or latitude to have conflicting ideas. The human being does have conflicting ideas by the fact that it's constrained into the physical entity. So therefore, if you take this concept a little further, how was the world created? The world was created by the convergence of spiritual ideas, by the limitation into physical space. That's essentially what it was. Where did that start? That started in Jerusalem. Right, in this Evan Shasia, Mimenu Hush Sasa Olam is when spiritual ideas were constrained into physical space, and from there outwards, the world around us exists. Which means that's why it is that human beings have an affinity with Jerusalem, because essentially, human being is an expression, a microcosm of that same idea, of spiritual ideas being, so to speak, cramped into one physical entity or space, which now can limit those ideas or contain those ideas, warring ideas with each other. Which now explains a very profound point, which is why it is that our prayers, the aperture of prayer throughout our lives always is Jerusalem, right? Because essentially what it is that we are a product of the same process of limitation and therefore conflict. And therefore, our prayers, when we are able to choose one spiritual concept and reattach ourselves to our spiritual quarry, it goes to the place where ultimately that was drawn from. Very interesting perspective in this. So a few examples of this, which are worthwhile noting, is just in halacha, the way this is expressed is the following. This is actually a halacha in Shulchan Aruch most people are not aware of, and that is the following. Let me just see if I can find this over here. Here we are. There we are, sorry. Put a lot of stuff in the notes, but we're not going to have a chance to get through most of it. But just some interesting perspectives. In source 22, in the Shulchan Aruch, this is in Sadi Dala, this is in Hilchos Tfilo, it says, "Bekuma lispalel," when you wake up in the morning to daven, "im hoya amed b'chutz la'aretz," if we are in the diaspora, as we are right now here, "yachzor ponov keneged eretz Israel," a person should turn their face towards Israel, "v'yachavim gam Yerushalayim," and you should turn towards Jerusalem, the Mikdash, the Beis Kodesh Kodashim. Hoya Amid Beretz Israel, let's say you are in Israel. Yaster Panov Keneged Yerushalayim. Your face should be facing Jerusalem. Yechaven Gam Lamok and the Mikdash, the Beis Kodesh Kodashim. You should face Jerusalem and the Mikdash. Imoya Amid Yerushalayim, Yaster Panov the Mikdash. Yechaven Gam the Beis Kodesh Kodashim. Imoya Amid Acharia Hakapores, Master Panov the Kapores. Meaning to say, there's always this focus in physical space. The spiritual energy that we are channeling has to always be channeled towards Jerusalem. Why is that? Because that is where it ultimately came from. We're, so to speak, returning to in the direction where we were nurtured from. The Midrash tells us in Source 23, and perhaps we'll close with this because it is somewhat esoteric. The Midrash says, "V'hu ve'echod mi'yishivenu v'nashra ibso v'yas," a pasuk in Iyov, "tana, ein malach echad," sorry, that's the Midrash we just talked about. I want to actually go to the... the following. Ah, here we are. Source 26. Gemara in Tanis, Hey, I'm on Aleph. V'amalei Rav Nachman Rav Yitzchak. Ma'adich zi bekir b'cha kadosh, v'loi ova bi'ir mishum bekir b'cha kadosh. Loi ova bi'ir, amalei hachi kama Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan explains a certain cryptic statement of a previous teacher. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Loi ova b'Yerushalayim shalmala, ad she'ova b'Yerushalayim shalmata. I will not enter the celestial Jerusalem until I enter into the terrestrial Jerusalem. So Hashem says, I will not, so to speak, allow spirituality. I'll not enter, I'll not allow the energy into the celestial sphere unless I'm actually in the terrestrial sphere, which means to say, where's the starting point for the convergence of spiritual forces? Only when it's limited into space, which is below. Once it's limited into space below, then the spiritual Jerusalem can have all those amalgamation of forces in it itself. That's the argument which he makes. This, in fact, explains a very complex Gemara. This is a very hard Gemara to understand, but we'll close with this today. And that is the Gemara in Brachos Dav Zayin Amud Aleph. The Gemara says, "Am Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yosi Minay Shakadosh Baruch Hu Mispalel." How do you know that Hashem davens? What does that mean exactly? So the Gemara says, "Shenem Avav Yosim El Har Kotshiva V'Simatim V'Veis Tefilasi." I'll bring them to my house of my prayer. Tefilasom Lo Nemar doesn't say their prayer. Ela Tefilasi my prayer. Mikan Shakadosh Baruch Hu Mispalel. Hashem davens. So the Gemara says, "So what? What does he say?" My matzle. That'd be a good text for the prayer book. So what does that mean? So Gemara says, Omar Rav Zutra Bar Tuvia Omar Rav. This is the tradition. Hashem says, let it be my will that my rachamim, my mercy, will supersede my anger. V'yegoilu rachamai al midosai, and my so to speak, my mercy will overcome my midos. So then I should overcome the strictures of din. Now, that doesn't mean to say HaKadosh Baruch Hu is passive, God forbid. That doesn't mean to say HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, is sitting there hoping that the wind blows in the right direction. What that means to say is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu ultimately, essentially gave us the tools of driving this train, and he's saying, I'm hoping that you're going to do the things necessary to allow me to act in such a way. Okay, so just that's sort of the structure. But if you think about it on a more deeper level, what essentially is happening over here is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chooses to act in the world through different apertures, through different spiritual apertures. One of them is din, one of them is rachmim. Those are what we'll call pu'ulos. They are not limitations of who Hashem is, but they are courses of action. Din, in a certain sense, is actually more that we'll call it the regular way the world runs. Right? The world is a quid pro quo. There's a certain system. We do X, Y happens, we do A, B happens, right? That's what we'll call din. We're not so good at that because we don't deserve too much. We don't live up to so much of our standards, which means to say that din itself would lend us to a very unfortunate outcome. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to supersede that with rachamim, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu will say, what should happen won't necessarily happen because you may be deserving or don't deserve, but I'm going to have rachamim on you. Which means to say, rachamim and din themselves are two spiritual concepts which don't coexist. Think about that for a second, right? Rachamim and din. If you're a very strict person, you regulate your children and you make sure that they never walk out the house without untied shoelaces and an unwiped nose. It's very hard for you to be the kind of person who's just laid back and says, okay, it's no curfew, it's all right, everything's all right, right? So it's very hard to put the two together. Those are different character types. So what, in a certain sense, what Hashem is saying is, I would like the one midah to converge over the other midah. Yigolu rachamai al midah din. How can that exist? Only in Yerushalayim. Meaning to say, only in Yerushalayim can HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, allow in the physical space, through the Evan Shasiya, the notion of one spiritual concept to overcome another spiritual concept, which is in the existence of Yerushalayim. That is the suggestion. I think it's a very profound perspective, something which requires a lot of thoughts, which also requires a little bit of titration when it comes to ourselves. So when we want to do something, we sometimes have physical, spiritual forces fighting ourselves, psychological forces, but they can only exist because of the constraints of the body. When the neshama is freed from the body, those concepts no longer are at war with each other. There's a certain peace, which is why we are in this world, is to create that peace before we have to leave it as well. This is Yerushalayim, the convergence point, not just historically, why it was chosen, not just we call in terms of the trade routes, the old, new, the east and the west, but also spiritually as the forces coalesce around Yerushalayim. I think this is a profound perspective, something worthwhile walking into our Yom Yerushalayim with, and I hope that it is a meaningful Yom Yerushalayim. Any thoughts, questions, observations? Folks, any thoughts? Yes.